So our topic for today, the third of our three, is borrowing without permission. And this comes up all the time in a variety of contexts. I'd like to look at three in particular. First, a pen that somebody leaves on a conference table. You walk into a room, there's a meeting, and you need to write something down, and there's a pen sitting on a table. Are you allowed to take the pen and use it? Either take it and keep it for yourself, or take it and then leave it there for the next person, whatever. Is that allowed? That's number one. Number two, the question of a sitter or a tallis found on a seat in shul. You walk into shul and you forgot your tallis at home, or maybe you're not someone who wears a tallis, but you get called up for an aliyah and you need a tallis and there's one sitting there. Are you allowed to use it? There's a sitter in the row in front of you, and instead of being a shul sitter, it actually has somebody's name in it. Are you allowed to daven with it? Different from the first case in the sense that it's a mitzvah. Now, you're not just using the pen for your meeting, but now you're using it to daven, to pray. Does that change things? And then third, similar to the first case with the pen, but let's say it's an umbrella and it's raining outside and you need to protect your suit. Are you allowed to use the umbrella then to save your suit from harm? I'm assuming, and I'm stipulating right at the outset, that we're not talking about Hashavas Aveda. We're not talking about the mitzvah of returning lost objects. I'm going to assume that whatever you have found is not lost. It was simply left there. In other words, the sitter is in the row because that's where the person davens. The pen is something that people forget, you know, and leave, and then they come back for it later. That's not a good example. Let's say it's a situation in which you wouldn't be able to return the pen to its owner because it has no identifying marks. It's a standard pen. All sorts of situations we can come up with. But those are the three that I'd like to deal with. Of course, it's important to remember right at the outset that our conduct with others is not only governed by strict letter of the law of is it theft for me to use this or not. It's also governed by the principle of Ehavta L'Recha Kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. So that even if something is technically permitted under the law, you need to ask yourself still, is it an appropriate course of action? So that's something to keep in mind. Okay. We begin with the case of the pen left on the conference table. If I were to ask you this question, you walk into this room here, and you're having a meeting, and you need to write notes, and you see a pen left on the table. Do you think that it's okay to use the pen?
It depends on the situation. What happens, let's say, that you should
have
the pen? Yeah. You have to be able to do San Francisco. It's obviously the Yiddish, the pen. The other thing is something you walk out the building and you have to go, wait a minute.
So Gershon raises a couple of key points. Number one, I'm going to stipulate that the owner did not lose hope. In other words, it really still belongs to him and it's his. So I'd like to avoid the question of whether he has abandoned hope of ever getting it back. But the other question is, what about the value? Difference in terms of the value, is it the sort of thing that comes in a 10-pack? Or is it a particularly nice pen? That's one factor. Yes, Dory.
I don't know if that matters in the sense that hotels give you pen to use in your room with a pad of paper, but you know there's no note that ever says feel free to take the note, the pad, and the pen when you leave the room because we'll refill it. There is for convenience. Should you need to use it while staying with us here, go ahead. But there's no ever stipulation that. You know, go ahead, take it with you. I mean, they don't mind if you do, in the sense that they'll refill it. They go, but I don't know that there's ever a clear cut that they say, go ahead, we expect you to take it.
So how would you now take that lesson and apply it to this question? In other words, that's fine to say that in the hotel room there's an understanding that you're able to use it. It was left for you. The pen that was left on the table, I dare say, was not left for anybody.
If it's not in a publicly stipulated place, then I guess it's not yours to use it.
Define public. Is this room here public?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
It's in a private entity.
Okay, maybe. Other thoughts?
I've experienced it several times. When it's in a hotel room, isn't it an expected form of advertising that wherever you take that pen and paper with you, oh yes, that is the Holiday Inn in Miami Beach, Florida.
Right.
So it's going to act as public relations.
Right.
That's going to go and impinge in the mind of the one who might be contemplating staying in the hotel. So it seems that in that context, it would be okay.
Yeah, my gut is not to deduce things from the hotel case. My gut is to agree with you that in the hotel case, they actually are happier when you take it with you. They tend to view it, indeed, as advertising, and it's branded that way. And I hope that's true, because I take the pens. But the core issue here is the issue that's called Shoel Shelo Midas, or Shoel Shelo Midat, which means borrowing from somebody without that person knowing that you are borrowing this. That's the core topic here. And the question is this a form of theft? Assuming he's not trying to use it right now, he's not even here right now. So take a look at the first source, please. A passage from the Talmud in Bava Metzia. It begins with a Mishnah, the core text from the beginning of the Talmud, from the 3rd century, and then it follows with commentary from the Gemara on it. Mishnah says, Hasholeach yad bepikadon. Let's say there is a pikadon. A pikadon means an item that someone specifically left in your care. Someone said, hold on to this for me. Not to use it. He didn't say anything about using it. He just said, I'd like you to watch the thing. And then, you are sholeach yad. You decide that you're going to use it. So someone gave you their fill in the blank, pen, book, watch, whatever it is, said, please hold this for me. And you said, hey, neat, I now have a pen. And you decide to use it. Beit Shammai Omrim, Ilaka Bechaser Ubiyeser. So Beit Shammai, one school of thought, says that the person who did this now has to pay for any depreciation or appreciation of the item. And what we mean by that is, number one, if it depreciates while in his possession, he's going to have to now go back to the person who asked him to watch it and pay him for any difference. That's number one. And number two, in the event that he actually uses the item and sells it off, and then it goes up in value, and then the person comes back to him and says, I'd like my item back, he's going to have to pay him, not based on what it was worth at the time that he took it, but based on what it's worth now. He's going to get stuck both ways, because he's viewed as a thief. That's essentially what Beit Shammai is saying, is we view this as theft when you use that item. Ubeis Hillel Omrim Kishas Hotzah. And Beis Hillel says you are going to have to pay. You pay based on what it was worth when you removed it from the owner, when you took it out of his possession. So we're not going to now make you pay for anything in addition to that, but whatever it was worth when you removed it, you're going to have to pay for it. The Gemara then challenges this, and the Gemara says, well, first it gives us a case. It says, Kigon Shetiltala Lahavi Alea Gozelos. An example. A case in which there's a ladder. It's someone else's ladder, and I take the ladder because I want to go get birds out of the dovecot. And the fundamental debate between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the question of what I need to pay if I use someone else's object, is based on a debate about borrowing without informing the person you are borrowing from him. Beis Shammai Sabri Shoel Shelo Midas Gazlan Havi. The view of Beis Shammai is that if you borrow something and you don't tell the person you're borrowing it, then you're a thief. That's what we call theft. The fact that you intend to give it back doesn't help. So therefore, any depreciation that takes place is your responsibility. You stole the item from him, and if it goes down in value, you're going to have to pay him for what it was worth at the time that you took it. That's Shammai. That's the school of Shammai. Beis Hillel, on the other hand, Beis Hillel Savri, Shoel Shelo Midas, Shoel Havi, Beis Hillel says, no, all you're doing is borrowing. Granted that the lender doesn't know he's a lender, nonetheless, you are a borrower, and therefore any depreciation that happens is in the possession of the owner. That's Beis Hillel's position. Don't get hung up on Beis Shammai versus Beis Hillel, because the next line is going to cancel out almost everything we just said. What we've said so far is that Beis Shammai believes that if you borrow without informing the owner, you're a thief. And Beis Hillel says, no, you're not. Along comes the Gemara and asks the key question. Ela hada amar Rava, Shoel Shelo Midas l'Rabbanan Gazlan Havi. Lema Rava damar ke Beis Shammai. The Gemara says, wait a minute. Rava is one of the latest of the sages of the Talmud, and Rava has his statement. He makes the statement that if you borrow something and you don't inform the owner, you are a thief. Flat. That's what he says. He doesn't leave it a subject to debate. Are you going to tell me that Rava, one of the latest and greatest of our halachic authorities, are you telling me that Rava would have sided with Beit Shammai? That there's a debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel about the status of a person who borrows something and doesn't inform the owner. And that Rava would have just taken the view of Beit Shammai? That's problematic. Why is that problematic?
Except for very few exceptions.
Right, because we normally follow the view of Beit Hillel. When there's a debate between the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, almost across the board, we are going to follow Beit Hillel. So, are you going to tell me that Rava was taking the view of Beit Shammai? The Gemara cannot believe that. And in fact, the conclusion of the discussion is, there has to be another way to understand Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Everybody agrees, as Rava says, that borrowing something without informing the owner is an act of theft. That's the upshot of the passage in the Talmud. And take a look at source number 2. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, Im yarad la betaras gezel, if I enter somebody else's boat as a thief, meaning I didn't give him any, give him any notice of it, I didn't ask him, I just went and used somebody else's boat, no sein hapachas, I have to pay for the depreciation and any other sort of damage that goes on. V'adinim not la das she'ela shalom idas gazlan havi, even if the person takes it to borrow it, planning I'm going to return it, nonetheless, he is indeed a thief. And that comes up in various areas in the Code of Jewish Law. Okay. Ramifications of calling this theft include liability for anything that happens to the item, even if it's something that I could not possibly have prevented. So, in a case in which you gave me your watch to hold on to, you say, do me a favor, Tuchina, take care of my watch. I say, fine. I take the watch, I put it down inside my house in a safe place, and then a bolt of lightning shoots through the window and zaps the watch. I'm not responsible. There are certain things you just don't anticipate happening. However, if I steal the watch and I put it in the same place in the house and the same thing happens, I am liable. The degree of liability is much greater for a thief. So that's an example. Jeff, you were going to ask a question.
That was my question.
Oh.
What if it's not thievery? What if you borrowed it and it was damaged? What's your responsibility?
Right. So the responsibility is greatest in this case. There's some debate as to whether this is biblical or rabbinic. In source number 3, you get the kind of humorous case of somebody who steals somebody else's book of Chidushei Torah, Torah novelties. There's somebody who has a book in which he's been writing his notes on the Torah he's been learning, and somebody else comes along and says, I am taking this and I'm going to copy it down. And the owner of it says, no, you can't do that. That's mine. And he says, too bad, I'm not giving it back. And the question comes to the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, in the 14th century, of, you know, what's the status here? Is this, how do we view this? So he says, Echav en ha-chaveirim gonav sifrei perushim l'chaveiro. One of the students in the study hall, in the Beis Medrash, stole a book of explanations of Torah, ukshatavo mimenu, and when the fellow demanded it back, nishba shivua chamura, shalo yachzirem lo ad sheyatik osam. He swore a solemn oath that he would not give it back until he had copied everything down. This comes up as one of the key source cases in discussion about intellectual property as well, because it's fundamentally intellectual property. It's information that's there, and I'm going to copy it and give you back your original. So, v'yeshahoru shemutar lagon vam, and the person who did this said, you know, I have heard rulings that say that this is entirely permissible, that you can do this. So, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, a very significant authority in Jewish law, says, Havalei b'hora'a so chote umachti. He says, anyone who rules that this is permitted is sinning and is causing others to sin by propagating this practice. V'agonev yeshalav gimel lavin, and he says, someone who steals violates 3 separate prohibitions in doing so. V'osa ha-mitzvah sh'niskavein la, lo also biyado, and the mitzvah he thinks he's doing, by now learning Torah using this book, he's not doing it all. He has not fulfilled any such mitzvah, because we have a principle in general that if a mitzvah is performed with a stolen item, the example he gives here is the stolen lulav on Sukkot, is not a mitzvah at all. So therefore, he says, you haven't fulfilled anything. But the key is that he describes this in biblical terms. He says, you violated three biblical prohibitions. He says, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah. In other words, as far as he's concerned, this is theft on a biblical level. Others disagree and contend that it's actually only a rabbinic prohibition. That does not make it a good thing to do. But perhaps it is specifically rabbinic. If you take a look at source number 4, a Mishnah in Bava Kamma. Hayamoshcha v'yotze umeis birishus habaylim patur. Let's say Dori has an animal in his yard. Okay, he's sitting opposite me, so I'm going to pick on him. Dori has an animal sitting in the yard. And I pull the animal out of the yard, but before I can get it out of the yard, it dies while still within his space. So the rule is, patur, I'm exempt from liability, assuming that my pulling it did not kill it. Assuming what I was doing did not contribute to its demise, you know, it's just bad luck that it happened to the timing, worked out that way, but I am not liable. I haven't done anything, to borrow a term from last week, I haven't done an act of kinyan that would make it my own, because it never left his yard and I didn't pick it up.
Supposing, what about the Shia? Let's say you do something in an unlocked car.
That's a completely separate point. Yeah, completely separate. I wouldn't go with that. Sorry. Meshicha, theoretically, drawing something towards you can be, but not while you're in his yard. In a public space, it would be. Higbiho, however, if he picks it up, Osho Tzio Merishos Habaylim, or he takes it out of Dori's yard, umeis, and then it dies, then Chayav, then he's liable, because then he has done something to actually make it his own. A thief is only going to be liable once he does this act of kinyan, this act of acquisition. Take a look, though, at source number 5, then. From Rabbi Yom Tov Elashbili, better known as the Ritva, commenting on a passage in the Talmud about a hatchet. He quotes the passage, Hashoal kardom mechaveiro. If I borrow an axe, if I borrow a hatchet from somebody else, baka bo kna'o. Lo baka bo, lo kna'o. Once I use it, if I chop with it, I have acquired it. It's now my responsibility. Until I use it, I have not acquired it. That's the quote from the Talmud. So the Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Elashbili, asks, Tamiya Milsi says, this is surprising. Dahasha'ela matana liyomahu amanas lahachzir. He says, I don't understand, because borrowing something is fundamentally like a temporary gift. If I borrow your hatchet, it's because you gave it to me to use for today, or for whatever the duration is of the loan. So why is it that the borrower does not acquire the hatchet just by pulling it toward him outside of the domain? In source number 4 we said, I pull the animal out of the domain, it's mine. So with the hatchet, I take the hatchet, and now it should be mine. So his answer is, he says, you know why? When you borrow something, you don't actually acquire it ever. He says, borrowing is not like receiving a gift. When you receive a gift, right, if someone gives me a can of Coke, then the can of Coke becomes mine. If someone lends me something, though, I never acquired the item. I acquired the use of the item. I acquired permission to write with the pen. I acquired permission to read the book. But the item itself never became mine. You follow the difference? Okay, when borrowing, you don't acquire the physical item. And therefore, pulling it doesn't make it yours. Using it is going to be what actually does. That's what's actually been assigned to you. So therefore, the Ritva continues in source number 5, and he says, "Benosein klila tashmisho, if you were to give somebody an item to use, she'ena tashmish davar yotzei migufo, where the use isn't part of the body of the item, it's a function that you do with it, lo shamanu she'nikne b'meshicha v'lo b'kinyin b'shum makom." He says, I never heard that you could acquire it at all by pulling the item. What's our point? Why are we bringing all of this? Because of the way it relates back to our discussion about borrowing without permission. Meaning, and this is a point made by the Divrei Mishpat on Choshen Mishpat. He says, if I borrow something without asking for permission, it's fundamentally built on the model of borrowing, not on the model of gifts. And therefore, biblically, I don't actually acquire the item ever. It's just the use of the item that I want. I'm not acquiring the item. So don't tell me that if I borrow without permission, I am now a thief. I was never acquiring the item in the first place. He says, biblically, I didn't acquire it. It's only rabbinically that the rabbis view this as an act of theft. Not biblically so. Jeff?
So, let's say the item that you borrow is a pen, but you use up half the ink, or you use up all the ink, and it's not refillable, and you give it back, and it's either essentially worth half of what it was from a functional point, or worthless.
Mm-hmm.
That's one question I have. The other question, going back to your original comments, for example, borrowing a lulav. So I'm in shul. I don't have a lulav in Etrog. It's time my friend, who has his, has stepped out. It looks like he's not coming back. I borrow his. I do hashanah or whatever. I make the bracha. So actually, I borrowed without asking him permission.
Right. So I'm going to come back to both of your questions.
Okay.
Because both of them are going to fit in as we go along. Yes, George.
Just throw another question. At a cottage, if somebody takes a boat that belongs to their neighbor and goes and, God forbid, there's an accident.
Who's got liability?
Who's got liability?
Right. So if I am to say that this is theft, then liability rests entirely with the person who took the boat.
Right.
Yeah. So one way to look at this, one way to look at this liability, or again, what we said is, number one, shor shalom idas gazlan hu. Borrowing something without asking for permission makes someone a thief. That's for sure. We said that the view of Rashba is that that's biblically defined as theft. We just saw a competing point of view that says it's rabbinically so, because borrowing, you don't acquire an item when you borrow it anyway. If you look at source number 6 on the top of the second side, Rabbi Yaakov Elisa, in his Nesivos HaMishpat commentary to the Code of Jewish Law on Choshen Mishpat, also takes the view that it's only considered theft rabbinically. Again, that doesn't mean you should do it. So, according to this, if we were to stop here, we would say that if there's a pen on a conference table, I better stay away. Right? If I walk into the room and there's a pen on the table, there's a book on the table, whatever it is, leave it right where it was. It's not yours, and it's theft biblically or rabbinically for you to take it. However, there are reasons to be lenient. Two in particular. Number one is where the item is not going to deteriorate. Where the item is expected to be used, and it'll still be there when the person comes back to get it, even if other people have used it in the interim. The normal case of a pen. Right? We assume there's enough ink in the pen that, you know, I can lend it to somebody else. He's going to use it during a meeting, and then afterwards I'll still have the pen to be able to use it. So in such a case, where the argument is it's not really going to deteriorate, it's subject to some debates. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Source number 7 deals with the question of what happens if I find someone's object, I want to return it to them. I'm holding on to it until I get a chance to return it, but in this interim period, I have to do something to maintain it. And potentially, that which I need to do is going to benefit me. So a classic example is that there's some kind of a carpet. Or not really a carpet, blanking on the word. Tapestry. Right? Then the tapestry needs to be unrolled every once in a while. It'll get moldy, you get worms inside it, whatever it is. It needs to be unrolled. So I say, well, I'm maintaining the tapestry for him. I think I'll hang it on my wall as my unrolling of the tapestry. Right? Is that okay? Or there's a scroll. And again, the scroll needs to be cycled through and read every once in a while. You have to open it up, or else, once again, it will deteriorate. There's a halacha like that regarding Sefer Torah, that if the Sefer Torah isn't used for a particular period of time, then it's actually assumed to be invalid, because things happen to a Sefer Torah. It's a big problem. But in any case, take a look at source number 7. Mishnah says, Matzah Ksus, if you find clothing, Minara echad l'shloshim yom, you should shake it out every 30 days. Vishot chalitzarcha, and spread it out for its benefit, avalo lichvodo, but not for one's own honor. I can't now say, well, I think I need to shake this out, maybe I should wear it around, you know, for my benefit. That I'm not allowed to do. So the Talmud asks, the Gemara asks, Ibayaluhu, litzarcha ulitzarcha ulitzarcha mai. What if it's going to benefit you, but it's also going to benefit the item? So on this, source number 8, Tosvot takes the position, Ukli nechoshes, he says, regarding copper utensils. D'tanya lekaman d'mishtamesh afilu b'chamen uklai kesef b'tzonein. We are going to learn in the Gemara, the Talmud's going to say, that you're allowed to use the copper items that you found, even with hot liquids, they can take it. And you can use silver liquids with cold, afilu l'tzorcho, even for your own sake, you're allowed to do it. Why? Because using it that way is not going to cause harm. What Tosfot says in this source, in source number 8, is that if I am maintaining the items that were left in my care, and I'm going to do it in a way that's going to help me, but the item won't deteriorate, I'm okay. Okay, even though I'm using it in a way that helps me, I'm serving it at my table. Nonetheless, it's not going to hurt the thing. I am allowed to use it. That's Tosfos' position. Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov El Ashbili, says not so fast. In the interests of time and clarity, I'm just going to say it outside, but you can see it in source number 9. He takes the position, quoting Ramban Nachmanides, that even if the item will not deteriorate, doesn't matter, you're still a thief. You can't do it. Using the item for your own benefit is against the law, even if the item is not going to deteriorate in its use.
We don't really try. Well, that's what you do. We don't really care what the owner. We're not trying to figure out what the owner might say. What we're not trying to.
Correct.
We don't know what the owner would say.
That's the next piece. Mind reading comes next. Are you? Okay.
So, I mean, we're taking a very strict, even rabbinic Torah, a very strict protection of property approach. That person owns something, they have all the rights to that property, and no one else has the right to the appropriate permission. That's the way we're taking it.
Right.
But I guess in some circumstances it may be possible to impute some sort of a different position if you had some basis from the owner's point of view.
Correct. And that is what's coming. So the first attempt is indeed to say something objective about using anyone's property in a circumstance in which you're not limiting his use of it, you're planning on giving it back, and it's not going to deteriorate. And there it's subject to debate. Tosfo says, you're allowed to. Ritva says, no, because all sorts of crazy things happen, and even if you know that your type of use isn't going to cause it to deteriorate, nonetheless, it could break, it could be harmed, things could happen. The greater reason to be lenient is if people normally allow this kind of use. Simply to say, everybody's okay with this. Don't assume that there's a problem. Everybody's really all right with this. If you take a look at source number 10, Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles codifies this in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. He's talking about a bench. There's a bench in front of somebody's house. It's that person's own bench. He says, I am allowed to sit down on the bench. I can rest there. With caveats. He says, Yesh Omrim, some say, Destam Safsal He She'ula L'Stam B'nei Adam. You can assume that an ordinary bench, meaning where I don't have any reason to think otherwise, it is indeed lent out to Stam B'nei Adam, to people in general. And if indeed someone sits down on the bench and it breaks, he's not liable. We treat it like an animal that you lent to somebody else, where the animal died as a result of normal work. So it was understood that it was going to be used that way, and therefore you're not liable for the damage to the animal. And here too, if a normal person sits down on the bench in a normal way and the bench breaks, it's not his problem. And he continues, Elam Kain Hayoshvim Hay Mishunim Ushmeinim Ukvedim Mishar Bnei Adam. Unless the people who sit down on that bench are unusually large, if the people who sit down on the bench are unusually large, then all bets are off. Then it's their fault for breaking the bench. But there is some kind of range of what is considered normal. And the assumption is people let other people use their benches. I'm just going to give Steve to pass around the sign-in sheet. Please make sure that you sign in so that we can set up follow-up on the class. If we already have your email address down, you don't need to enter your email address. Unless you want to, in which case, feel free.
Can I ask a question? So
yes.
What happens if this is that you have a trench coat in shul, and it's cool. Someone else, and then all the coats are gone, and someone took your trench coat, and you take, so you say, I'm going to take his trench coat. Let's say they're very similar, but they're not exactly the same. So what goes through my head would be, well, it's his fault. He was negligent putting me in this situation. I complained that I used his coat, because then I wouldn't have had to use it if he wouldn't have taken my coat. So
You're assuming, of course, that this is just there are only two parties involved in this.
Well, I think, yeah, usually if there's a local theft and versus God, another one's dead that's similar, you would make that assumption. So, but I don't know if the rabbis would go that far. They might say, well, you know what, it was an honest mistake on his part or whatever, and you can't assume that he would be happy with you wearing his coat around.
Right. Sir Moshe Feinstein has a response on this question, in which he recommends for shuls that they have a policy of basically whoever comes out with whatever they come out, you know, it's theirs for that day until things can get settled out. As an official policy. I wrote up something on this, actually. It was in the bulletin at the Bayit last winter. So this is a good reason to sign in. So I will email you that paragraph that I wrote up on it, because there are more sources to see. But basically, this is a topic of great discussion, the shul coat room. You know, what do we do about you could do actually a three-part series on the shul coat room. The coat room kiddush, the coat room losing your coat, all sorts of fun stuff. Okay. Right. No, there actually is. I mean, that's the idea. Okay. So, Belina, there I will send that around later on. But in terms of this heter, this leniency, the idea is saying, it's true you are a shoel shalomidas, you're borrowing without permission. Nonetheless, not everybody requires permission for everything. The people are good in general with certain uses of their property, and they don't mind. There are caveats to this. One caveat to it is, if the owner wants to use it right now, then I can't say to him, well, you allow everybody to use it, right? You can't sit down on the bench. I'm sitting here. It doesn't work. That's number one. Number two is that it has to be something that everybody allows. Take a look at source number 11 from Rishner Zaman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, in a Shulchan Aruch Harav. Look at the standard he sets up here. He says, you can't use someone else's item. Ela im kein yadua lo beberur, shelo yakbid ala baal hachefet, unless you know clearly that the owner will not mind, meaning this person doesn't mind. Oh, shu davar she'ein derech kol b'nei adam lahakbid olav klal, or that nobody cares about. That's your standard. Either this person or the universe of people. As opposed to knowing that the majority, he continues to say, knowing that the majority of people don't mind is insufficient. You have to know that nobody minds. Now, there's no such thing as 100%. But we're not saying you have to be at 100%. But you have to be closer to 100% than to 51%. You have to be at the stage that we would be comfortable saying everybody is good with this. That's the standard that he sets, and it is a very high standard. The other caveat is that your use should not be unusual, like the case of the very large person sitting on the bench. So that's the basis for leniency. The basis for leniency is, everybody's good with this, or I know this person and he's good with this. How do I know? Last week he lent it to me. However, I determined that it's okay. That's the standard. That's in terms of a general item like a pen. But now we move into the case of the mitzvah item. And with mitzvah items, we have greater grounds for being lenient. If you take a look at source number 12, it's a Gemara in Pesach. I'm talking about somebody who rents out a house for use on Pesach. Let's say you're going to go to this house you're renting for Pesach. You're going there on Erev Yom Tov, right? On the 14th of Nisan, you're ready to make the Seder that night. And the understanding was that the house had been checked for Chametz already, because the night before was when it was supposed to be checked. So your assumption going in was, this house has been checked. And lo and behold, Matzo She'eno Baduk, you find that it wasn't checked. Mahu, now what do you do? You thought that it had been checked. Turns out it's not. Miavi kemekach tos, olo, do we view this as fraud? You were cheated, or not? So Toshma, come in. Here they say, Damar Abaye. Abaye said, Afilu, and I jumped a little bit in the interest of space, Afilu ba'asra diyavi agra ubadku. It is not fraud, Abaye says. And even in a place where the practice is to pay people to search, and therefore I, the renter, am now going to need to go pay somebody. It's going to cost me money because this wasn't done. Nonetheless, nechole le'inish le'kayume mitzvah b'mamone. People are happy to fulfill a mitzvah with their money, with their assets. So the principle is that people are happy when others are going to perform a mitzvah with their assets, or in this case, where he's going to perform a mitzvah with his assets. In other words, he doesn't mind. It's not considered fraud. Everybody goes home relatively happy. That's the core idea. And now, based on that, I could say, lulav, siddur, no problem. Talis, go ahead and use it.
Is that based on the idea that that's what people think? Or is the Torah, or are they saying that's what people should think? And we're going to treat them as if they think that way in order to inculcate that in them. In other words, that would be...
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Thing ...to think, even though people might not really think that way.
Right. That's a really good question. It sounds like an objective principle that this is what people will think. However, we're going to see certain exclusions that indicate that maybe this actually is person dependent, and it's not really a dictate like that. It's a baseline assumption until you know otherwise. But if I know otherwise, then it's not so. First of all, the one principle which the Pischei Choshen, a work on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, and this section of Choshen Mishpat dealing with business law, the Pischei Choshen notes, that doesn't work where there's a concern that your use may ruin the item. So in other words, if someone has a fragile sitter that's from his great-grandmother, and that's what he uses, you can't say, well, people are happy if their property is used for a mitzvah, I'm going to go daven with this sitter. That doesn't work. Where there's concern for damage, that's not relevant. And if it is damaged, the assumption has to be going in that you are required to pay for it. In the event that you use someone else's mitzvah item, going on the basis of people are happy to have their items used, and then it's hurt, you're now going to have to, you are going to have to pay for it.
Well,
yes?
So, in a dual scenario, somebody goes on to put someone else's tefillin, and whatever happens, the box opens up on the thread.
Yeah.
The person who borrowed is responsible to re-thread the tefillin box.
Yes. Yes. So, applying this to the two standard cases I mentioned in the beginning, one, the talis, and two, the sitter. When it comes to a talis, you see in source number 13, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, Mutar litol talis chavero ulevarecha aleha. You are allowed to take someone else's talis and make a bracha on it. The question of making a bracha on someone else's talis is its own discussion. But he says, you can take it and make a bracha. Ubilvad shekapel osa im mitzah mikupeles, assuming that, if you found it folded, you will refold it. I'm allowed to use the talis. Flip the page, please, to source 14. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, in his Mishnah Berurah commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, notes, Davka be'akra'i abo be'kvius asur. You can only do this once in a while. You can't do this every day, right? Every day I'm going to walk to shul and take someone else's talis and use it. That's not considered appropriate. He doesn't say why. I don't know if it's because we just in general find this idea offensive, or whether it's because people are actually fed up and therefore they don't permit it anymore. That's not clear. Yes? So folding it on Shabbos is its own discussion. Am I allowed to fold it? What if I fold it with a plan to refold it after Shabbos? The folding a talis on Shabbos is its own debate in its own right. So I'm not going to... in a chanami. True. We generally avoid it, but there are grounds for leniency. So I wouldn't take a stand on it right now.
So my talis stays in shul on Shabbos. My Shabbos talis is in my talis bag. You mean somebody can come, open the bag, and take my talis and wear it on an occasional basis, and that's fine?
Yeah.
I was always assuming they wouldn't.
Well, maybe there's a need for a note.
No, I would not be very much in favor of it happening either, but...
Well, no, but that's a good question. I mean, keep in mind the fundamental point that you made when you gave us the scenario. It's folded up, and it's zipped away in the talis bag. I think there is something to be said for interpreting the body language, so to speak, of the person who put it away. In other words, if someone puts something in a locker, that's different from leaving something on a bench. I've said a bag, it's different from leaving it out of a bag. I think that you do have to look at it and say, well, how careful was the person to keep this from public view? How careful were they to put it in storage? But the default assumption indeed is that people are good with it, but keep on reading because there's also an additional point that should be noted. Afilu ba'akroi, even if you are only going to do it occasionally, davka ba'oso makom, you're only allowed to use it on that site. Right? In that in the space where it was found. Avalot Siomi Basil Besaknesis, taking it from your from the house to shul, O Ifcha or opposite us, or it will be prohibited. And then he continues to say as well, quoting the Prima Gadim, that if the owner is present, you have to ask. You can't say, well, I assume it's all okay. It doesn't work that way. A person would be obligated to actually ask. So that's the Talus. Interestingly, when you get to a sefer, when you get to using someone else's book, the stance is different. In the source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, writes on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, Aser lilmod misfarim shel chaveru b'lo daito. You may not learn from someone else's books without his knowledge. D'chayshin an shema yikra osam b'limudo, because we're worried that it might tear. And indeed, the Prima Gadim, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, mentions a sitter in particular and says you can't use somebody else's sitter. What's the difference between sitter and talus? It's a lot easier to damage a sitter, and we're looking at the Ramah. Right? When does the Ramah live? End of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century.
Or printing.
Well, printing exists, but it's early printing.
Books
were much more expensive and much harder to find. Or if you have a scroll, you know, the scroll gets damaged, it's a lot harder for you to get a hold of a new scroll. So take a look at source 16. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein is the rabbi in Novardok in the beginning of the 20th century. And he writes, Ata, nowadays, Shasfarim nidpasimu mitsuyim, books are printed and they're common, Nirali sheyachol litol lilmod bosha kala shalomi daito. It appears to me that you would be allowed to take it, to learn with it for a little while without his knowledge. Vlogara mitalis utfilin, it's no worse than talis and tfilin. Imlo sheyodea shabaila makbidim bazeh, again, assuming that one doesn't know that the owner minds. But that's his statement, is that books today would have a more lenient status than they did 500 years ago. That's the idea. One other note, because the Pischei Choshen, Rav Amram Bloy in his Amram is not his first name, Rav Yaakov Bloy in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, does note that if it's a book from a shul, you are not allowed to take it out of the shul. He says the default assumption of shul is that you're not allowed to take it out of the shul, and he says you're definitely not allowed to give it to children to play with for them to be quiet during davening. He says that's not an appropriate use of a sitter, and the pages get torn, and he goes on to, he has a hefty piece there in his commentary about this. So just noting that. But again, what we've said is, in general, when it comes to using someone else's property, you're not able to use it without his permission. We said that in the event that you know it won't deteriorate, so there's a debate. In the event that you know he doesn't mind, or that no one minds, then you're allowed to use it. And now if it's use of an item for a mitzvah, then we have greater reason to permit, again, assuming no deterioration is likely. Now, Jeff asked the question about the lulav. With a lulav, you have another issue. On the first day of Sukkot, you have to use a lulav that you own. So that makes it a little trickier in terms of first day of Sukkot, worth considering. One more question, though, to expand our understanding. Take a look at source 17, please. Source 17 is the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim. Rabbeinu Nisim writing in, I think, the 13th century, maybe 14th, on the case of the house that I rented thinking it had been checked already, and it turns out it wasn't checked. So he writes, Acherim Kasvu, others have written, that when we say that people are happy to have their objects used or their assets used for a mitzvah, he says, it's one thing to say it's not considered fraud when it turns out I have to hire somebody to check. However, the landlord is going to have to pay me back. Because even if I'm happy to go, you know, to arrange this, nonetheless, he's going to have to pay me back for it. That's a little bit of an odd comment. given that we've already said you're happy to have your assets used, so what's the big deal? So the Magen Avraham, Rabbi Avraham Gambina, writing on the Shulchan Aruch, says it depends on the degree of loss. It depends on just how much of an expense this is. That will determine it. But there's another work called Tumat Yesharim, which has a very interesting idea. He says, people are happy to have their item used for a mitzvah. That's true. Even if it will potentially degrade in the process, they're happy. It doesn't matter. It'll cost me money. That's fine. But they aren't happy about collateral damage. As in, money you end up spending that's not part of the mitzvah proper. So, for example, I am happy to have someone else use my talis. But if they're going to leave the talis in a way that it's going to get stained, and now I'm going to have to pay for dry cleaning, that I'm not happy about, because that wasn't the necessary component of the mitzvah. That's the distinction that he sees there. And he says, when it comes to the search for chametz, he says, maybe we view paying somebody to search as not inherent in the mitzvah. Maybe that's a potential difference. That's just an interesting side note. But the core idea here is that that when it comes to a mitzvah item, where there is no concern that it'll be ruined, then indeed the default assumption is people are happy to have it used. One other item to discuss quickly, and that is the umbrella case. So when you're dealing with the question of an umbrella and it's raining outside and you need to... it was in the interest of time. We have a couple of minutes. I'll mention 18 briefly. The Rush is quoted in the Ramah in source number 18. He says he's dealing with the question at a time when books are indeed very expensive and therefore people don't want to lend them out. So he writes, "Umakom bitul Torah, in a case where there will be a loss of Torah study, shein svarim nimtzam, because there aren't books around. So if I'm going to keep my library to myself and I won't lend them out, the result is that people won't be able to learn. Based in, the courts are actually able to compel me to lend my books out to others, and they have to pay me for any damage that takes place. But I'm not allowed to hoard Torah to myself, even though the books are actually mine." The court...
Based in is the guarantor here, or the borrower?
No one's a guarantor. The court takes it and says, let anybody use it, and then everybody else is responsible to pay you for whatever happens.
Not the based in.
That is correct. That's the idea. It must be that the Rush believes in the principle of Zeh Nehneh V'Zeh Lo Chaser, that where one person is going to gain and no one else is going to lose, not only do we believe then you're obligated to help because you're not losing anything, but we're actually going to compel you to help. That leads to other discussions that go beyond this. But that was an interesting piece, I thought, in this Ramah. What about in the umbrella case? So just very briefly, just to mention it, there is a principle that says that I am allowed to use somebody else's property in order to save my property from harm, so long as the harm I am avoiding is greater than the harm I'm going to cause to that other person's property. So in other words, if I have a suit that costs a couple of $100, and there's an umbrella that's a $5 umbrella, so even in the event that the umbrella is a total loss after this rainstorm, nonetheless, I am saving more money than the value of the umbrella, because the suit's damage would be greater than the $5 umbrella. You follow?
But you have to compensate if the umbrella gets damaged.
So take a look at source number 19. It talks about taking someone else's donkey in order to save your property. You need to go bring it to a certain place and load up the donkey to save the property from wherever it is. Then lakach lahatzila shalom. If you take the donkey to save your property, verotz alite in the balachamor efseido, and you're willing to pay the owner for any loss, lo havi gazlan, then you're not a thief. The tanai based in who, and the reason is because this is what we call communal agreement, social contract, if you will, that everyone's property is available for others to use in order to save their property from harm, assuming that the harm that they're being saved from is greater than any damage to the person who owns this property. That's by default our assumption within society, and so I would be allowed to take that umbrella, again, assuming I know he doesn't need it. If he needs the umbrella, then I'm going to create problems. That's another story. But otherwise, that would be allowed. There's more to say on that. I had a whole other section on what if I intend to pay for the use of the item. That fits in too, but it's beyond what we're going to get to. Sorry?
How can you make that assumption? You're using the umbrella because it's extremely rainy outside. How can you assume that the owner doesn't need the umbrella to protect his property?
Right, you'd have to come up with a case in which that's true.
He may not be there.
you don't know that he's not in another room and coming in. And you have to deal with the circumstance as it is. In other words, if you have a circumstance where you know, good. If you don't know, then I think you're not able to act.
So you have to be able to confirm for yourself that it is will.
Yes. So again, to sum up in one sentence, we said that in general, I am not allowed to use other people's items without permission, even if I know that it won't harm the item. Nonetheless, that's still subject to debate. If I know that everybody allows, then I will be allowed to use it, assuming that it's going to be a normal use. So to go back to your question about half the pen, assuming that it's going to be a normal use, I'm allowed to do it. Assuming that I know that all people don't care, or I know that he doesn't care, if it's an item that's going to be used for a mitzvah, and again, it's not going to be ruined, then I have more justification. And if it's an item that I'm going to use to save myself from greater harm, then I have all the more justification to be able to use it. I will note once again...